Okay, we'll start class just momentarily. Good morning, everybody. Picking up today with Cornelis. We'll resume from where we left off. Chapter 5, verse 6. I will just review the last few verses since we didn't have a class last week, so we'll just refresh ourselves. And we'll just start in a few moments. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Rabbi.
How's everybody doing? How are you doing, Rivka?
Baruch Hashem, thank you.
Good.
Thank you. I hope everybody is well.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Rabbi, so far, Naomi and Doug and Jim and Josh are on, as far as I know.
Okay, very good. And we've got Naomi. Naomi is on the phone.
Oh, and Cal. Hi, Cal. I can hear you before. Sorry.
And looks like Irina is on from Plainview, and Naomi's on from India, and Tina in New Jersey. So good morning to everybody. We're going to continue where we left off. And that is chapter 5, verse 6. And we'll just review briefly what we were discussing. We were in the whole area of speech and where the corruptions lie. And King Solomon had stated that in the beginning, we talked about, and again, we don't pay attention to the chapter breaks because that was created by the Gentiles. We pay attention to the content, to the flow of the content. So it was the last verse in chapter 4, which talked about a person being careful not to just offer rote prayers or meaningless sacrifices when he goes to the house of God. He said over there about, and that began the whole topic matter of where a person's speech can be corrupt. And he stated that you should wash your feet. And we stated the word feet, which is regel, also has another connotation, and that is something which you just do by rote. You just habituate yourself. And it makes sense because we said that when a person walks, he doesn't have to concentrate on, you know, moving his left foot, then his right foot. It's just such an ingrained activity, he could be absent-minded when he does it. So they use the same term when you're just doing something very rote. So when he says in 4:17 that you should watch your feet when you go to the house of God, and he is very close, meaning he can hear whatever you're saying. So you should be careful not to do what? From giving over prayers that are like fools. And the people just say things and there's no meaning behind their words. And we also said that the reason behind the warning having to do with speech is, like Doug pointed out, that speech is one activity where cognition and focus is essential. You can't speak if you lose you know, your concentration, but you can wave a lulu, you can do other type of physical commands without any real, you know, high level of functioning. But you can't do that when you're formulating statements. So there the mind is involved. So like you said, Doug, so therefore that's where the warning has to do with speech, because the mind is much more engaged when you're speaking. You're formulating sentences, you're expressing thoughts. So there is much more of a sin when you're doing something rote, because then the very requirement is lost, which is not the case if you're, you know, you do a rote activity, you pick up little, there's a whole discussion in the Talmud whether or not you need intent at all. When you do a command, you just put on your tzitzis, you put on your tefillin, you wave the lulav, whatever the activity is, you do the action, then you fulfill the command. Not so when the command is speech. Okay, because there the mind is engaged. And then it's, if there's no intent, then there's really nothing done at all. It's worthless. And we saw some commentaries even said that it's really better off that a person doesn't pray if he can't, we can't really focus. Okay. But that was all talking about prayer and sacrifice. Then he moves on into different ideas. And we go over the classes again for the specifics. Different emotional angles. Very facets to it. And he said an interesting statement in in verse 2 in chapter 5. And he said, you should minimize your words because God's really in heaven. Why? Because a dream comes with a multitude of matters, and the voice of a fool with many, many words. Now, I'm citing that verse again because look at our verse today. And you see that after that he goes into verse 3, which is, when you make a promise, don't delay in paying it. Because that's a real obligation. That's a halachic, a Torah obligation that you have to fulfill your words if you make a statement, if you make an oath. So we talked about oaths 2 weeks ago also. And King Solomon advised you in 5:4, it's better off not to make an oath than to make an oath and not pay. And then we briefly talked about how it seems to be so obvious. What does King Solomon have to tell you this for? It's better off not to make an oath than to make an oath and not pay. Evidently, there is an assumption. And again, we always, our practice is when we learn together is that we keep going back to the rule that if you have a verse, that means it's addressing an opposing notion that we would think otherwise. So therefore, it's necessary to have a certain verse telling you. So therefore, what we always ask, what is this trying to correct? So he said that verse 5:4 is trying to correct the notion that a person feels that making an oath, even if I don't fulfill it, there's some good in the fact that there was the attempt. So that's what King Solomon is correcting. He says, no, it's better off that you don't make the oath at all than making it and not fulfilling it. Don't think that there's any benefit in the fact that you had good intentions. Because then it really shows your intentions as being false. So in good intentions, you know, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Which means to say that intent is worthless in terms of a human being. A human being is designed in a way where the only true measure of a person's values is through his actions. And that's why mitzvah is such an integral component to our lives. Okay. And then we went on last week.
I was just thinking, I don't know, I wouldn't say that like intent is completely worthless because, I mean, I think it shows the way that the person wants to go. I mean, sometimes, let's say, you know, he can't do something because, you know, he's got other reasons, but, you know.
If a person was intending on going to synagogue and he starts walking and he falls in the ice and sprains his ankle and he can't walk, there we say the person has the perfection because he went through the action already to demonstrate it, but there was something outside of his control that prevented him. But if a person, and that's what King Solomon says clearly here, if a person, he says, better off not to make the promise than to make the promise and not fulfill it. Because if it's all you're doing, that means the words were really just a lie. Because if there's nothing else which is coercing you, like, you know, falling on the ice, well, that wasn't your fault, or a truck hits you, or something like that. So that's out of your control. So then the person has the same perfection, because it wasn't due to his change of heart that he didn't go to temple that day. It was due to external circumstances that he could not have forecasted or prevented. But if a person makes a promise and he doesn't fill it, that shows that his promise was really empty. Because it was a true, a real value that he had, he would fulfill it. So I disagree. See, clearly, I think that's what King Solomon is saying here. That it's better off not to make the promise. What does he say? Why does he say, according to you, that it's better off not to make the promise?
You know, okay, to your point, and I remember something I learned that when a person makes a promise, I think it was in Kevot, that when a person makes a promise, in his mind, it's like it's already like an accomplishment, so it makes him less likely to accomplish it if he's made a promise. It's like in his mind, he's already like satisfied that, or when he talks, he's like satisfied that he's already fulfilled his the action.
And therefore,
it's better not to talk, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yes, see, it sounds like you're agreeing now, that the person feels like he really did something now just by making the promise, but in fact, he's fooling himself. So King Solomon is saying that's a lie.
Yeah, when I was disagreeing, I was kind of thinking about, like, I don't know, somebody who's just very, very, very busy, and practically they want to do something, and they're just too busy to do it. You know, so I mean, it's, you know, there's definitely people like that who
are just
busy with other things, but they don't get a chance.
But a person's responsible for their thoughts and their speech. So if you really didn't have full comprehension of what you're getting into when you made the promise, so that was a sin. And he says, don't even delay in the previous verse. He says, not only is it that you should pay, but you shouldn't delay. And if you promise to do something at a certain time, that's now a Torah obligation upon you. That's a reality. So a person has to look at that, but people don't. And the next verse is really how, you know, goes into explaining. Let me just see if Gabrielle and Arena, if you could just type on screen if you hear the audio okay. I just want to make sure everybody's listening, that the audio is coming through all right. So just Gabriel and Arena, let's see. That Naomi, it's working fine for you. Okay. Is it clear, Naomi?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks.
Okay. So now you look at what we did last week, the next verse, which is 5:5. King Solomon says, don't give your mouth over to sin against your flesh. And don't say before the angel that, it was a mistake. You know, don't try to excuse yourself. What do you mean before the angel? Meaning, like the Ibn Ezra said, that everything is written down. Angel just meaning God's forces. God has his methods by which everything is being recorded. So what the person said is it's severe. Don't look lightly at it. See, that's the whole sense of that verse, is that he says, don't let your mouth sin, cause your flesh to sin. Don't give over your mouth to cause your flesh to sin, because we said he's giving a very subtle but very important lesson, and that he's exposing the dichotomy in the human mind, how a person looks at his speech is one thing, but what my body does, that's real. Actions are real, but speech is excusable. That's what he's trying to tell you is not true. When you take on an oath, now speech has obligatory weight. I mean, it's something which you now have to do. And then he's trying to say that it'll cause your flesh to sin, what I mean, through your inactivity, if you don't fulfill what your words were from your mouth. So now he's trying to bridge the gap. Don't think that your mouth is one thing and you buy something else and you can try to excuse yourself before God, which euphemistically the verse says, don't say before the angel, oh, it was just a mistake. No, you're not going to get off the hook. And he says, why should God be angry with you? Right? Why should he be angry on your voice and then destroy your actions? I mean, God will now, and we didn't say this last time, but God will do as a response. And again, God punishes only those who he loves, King Solomon says in another place. But he says that he will then disrupt your activities. He'll bring a downfall to you in your actions in order to show you that this is not due to your speech, that your speech is reality. And if you say something, in terms of an oath, you took on a Torah obligation, you made a verbal oath, and now you don't fulfill it. So God will now show you how it's akin to any physical action that you did, which is wrong, by giving you the same type of punishment. It says to correct you. But you see, that's the point that King Solomon is trying to bring out in verse 5. That a person is dichotomized, they'll try to excuse himself. Oh, it was really just words. No. It's really going to be your mouth by making a promise that you don't fulfill is going to cause your flesh to sin by inactivity. And then the response is going to be that God's going to punish you physically, not just verbally. You're going to get a physical punishment to show you that your inactivity is really, it's a sin just as much as you sinned with any other action, like stealing. Okay? And that brings us up to speed where we left off. So let me just see if there's any, if that's clear so far. Okay, I'll assume the silence means that everything's all right. Okay. Now we're up to the new verse.
Okay.
So it's 5:6. So now he says like this. But he starts off the verse with the word key, because. So of course we can't just read that in a vacuum. That means it's a continuation of the previous thought. So, he says, for Kiperov Cholomos, because this happens with many dreams, the Havalaman, with futilities, and much speech. Rather, God you should fear. Okay, Tina, good. Thanks for the note online. Thanks. And... all right, so let's just read it again. It's a brief verse, but how does it fit into this whole sequence of verses? So the previous verse, he said that you shouldn't cause your lips to make your sin flesh. Your flesh sin. Meaning, by the fact that you don't fulfill your words, you're going to cause your flesh to sin, meaning that inactivity. And don't try to excuse yourself. And then why should you make God angry that he, on your words, and he will destroy your ways? And then it continues, for with many dreams and futilities and much speech, meaning, how do you fit that in? It seems to be he's giving a reason. So what is he saying here? And now you'll go back to verse 5:2, and you'll see again he talks about dreams and many words. So, that was one of the lessons we saw over the time we lived together, is that when the Torah has repetition, it's bringing out something. It doesn't want you to miss that, so it repeats it. But you see there's a link. So what's that link? But there's a slight difference, too. Yes, Doug?
You just read the verses, for with many dreams and futilities and much speech only fear God. Translation I'm looking at says, for despite many dreams and vanities and many words, only fear God.
Okay, that's all right. We can go with that.
Either one.
Yeah, it's a tough verse, but...
I just want to make sure I got the facts right.
Right, well, the verse starts off with the word because or for. So you can't start off a new subject matter with that. There has to be a continuation of the previous thought. So that's what I'd like to see is how... this fits in, but also what's the lesson just in the verse 6 alone. So there's two things we have to understand. The lesson of the verse, and also how does it fit into the context. And the third thing, of course, is what's this repetition of dreams and much speech?
Yeah, I guess my question is, in the very beginning, is it for with or for despite? Because it seems like that would lend a different meaning. Depending on which approach we take.
The way I'm understanding it, and I could be wrong, is that he's attributing the flaw in verse 5 to the elements he talks about in verse 6. I mean, 6 really is an explanation of why you make these flaws in 5. meaning all this is done, and then he says in a very just, you know, abbreviated way, because of, for, on account of maybe, on account of many dreams and futilities and lots of speech. So then you put a comma there, but what should you really do? Rather, you should fear God. Meaning, the sins of what's going to happen in five, that you're going to cause, your speech is going to cause your flesh to sin by the inactivity of not fulfilling your promise. And then you're going to try to excuse yourself because you're going to look at speech as being much more insignificant than action, which is not true. Because anything which you commit yourself to, is whether you did an action or whether you said you're going to do something, is equal. So that's what King Solomon was trying to show you. But where is this error generated from? Why does a person have this type of end up with an error? Because if he only tells you what happens, what's the sin in verse 5? Because you're going to say something with your mouth and you won't fulfill it in action, and then you're going to try to excuse yourself, but God's still going to punish you physically in order to demonstrate that what you said was really, you never fulfilled it. But now I believe verse 6 is telling you why this happened.
Well, is he suggesting that, okay, in life you're going to have lots of dreams, lots of things come up, lots of words that pop into your head or that could come out of your mouth, and that you need to be very careful to discern that which is true and correct and leave off the rest, which is sort of the fear God part? In other words, be diligent all the time, and you need to be focused on what's really true, not all the sort of fluff that's floating by.
Okay. So what does he bring dreams in for?
Well, dreams are one of those things that replays back to us perhaps certain aspects of what's going on in our psyche that may or may not be valid.
Okay, good. Good. Swarner talks a bit about what it seems to be like the key point, and that is imagination. And I believe that's another basic idea that he brings up both in verse 2 and in verse 6 when he talks about a dream comes with many matters. That's one thing. But our verse is slightly different. He says with many dreams. So there's two elements that have a plurality. There's the component of a single dream is numerous. The components of dreams are numerous. In 5:2, because a dream is constructed of many, many matters. And the reason why, because a person has imagination. Imagination is something which is non-stop. There's things we perceive, and then we think about, and the fleeting thoughts, the things that pass through our mind during the day. There's so many, there's so much stimuli, and there's so much memory, and there's so much just internal desire without the stimulus, that the mind could be a complete, a confusion of things. And that's really what a dream is, when the intelligence is not structuring your thoughts or making your plans for the day, meaning during sleep that's absent. So that's why dreams are so hard to recall, because there's no sequence, there's no order. You can remember things which are much more ordered, because you can go this happened, then that happened, then that happened. Okay, but if there's no order, and it's just fleeting thoughts without any structure, that's why dreams are very hard, very difficult to recall. But he's saying, number one, in verses in 5:2, dreams are constructed of many matters. But then he says in 5:6, an explanation of why a person is going to make the sin, he'll make an oath, but he won't fulfill it. He seems to be saying, and I think you're touching on it, Doug, that a dream. Why does he have to bring in dreams? We're talking about speech, a person that doesn't fulfill his promises. So what does a dream have to do with anything? And he talks about three matters. He talks about multiple dreams, numerous dreams, and a lot of futilities, and much speech. what I believe he's trying to show you, he's bridging. See, the speech is really the issue here, because we're talking about a person who doesn't fulfill his promises. But he wants to trace back and show you that it's the same person that has numerous dreams that also is going to make numerous promises. It's coming from the same source, the imagination, like you're saying, Doug. You see? That's why he says, this all happens because of the same, and he tries to bring up dreams because then a person agrees is completely haphazard and is just out there. And a person really devalues dreams. It's not even a reality. So on one hand, it may not be reality because it's with your unconscious. But on the other hand, it's very much a reality. It's very much a part of you. Those dreams are really, they're your dreams. And somebody else, another person has his own dreams. So it is generated from your own workings. So if that's the first step King Solomon does, is he gets you to realize that dreams are something which have reality to it. Of course, we're not saying that they're fortuitous or that any measure. That's not what we mean by reality. It means that it's generated from you, and you're real. Your feelings, your emotions, your aspirations, your fears, those are real. And just like the dreams come from you, so also is this corruption of making these promises, or like Swarno reminds us about the person who comes to the temple and he just says a lot of things and he just feels by saying a lot and he just rushes through his prayer. That's also a corruption. But he's trying to show you where it emanates from. And that's the person's imagination. I mean, the imagination allows a person to think, yeah, I could say this, and to Naomi, your point before, a person intends on doing something but they don't do it, well, that means they were just imagining. They were imagining they could really do it. They were imagining they really wanted to do it. They weren't really being true. Person really is 100% convinced of something. Not only will he do it, but many times he won't even have to say it because he's going to do it. There's no reason to say it. We talked about the fact that an oath has a place in Judaism because sometimes a person is too weak to do something on his own. And therefore he makes an additional obligation upon himself, which is not part of the Torah system, but just temporarily because he needs it just to get him back online, to get him back into to the right groove. So an oath can have a benefit. That's why it's part of the Torah structure. That's why God endorses it. But you see that, I think that's why he's bringing up dreams and he's tying it together with much speech, because where does a person's, he says in verse 2, that the words of a fool are with much words, meaning he speaks a lot. Where does a lot of speech come from? A lot of speech is not necessary for communication. A person can communicate an idea very briefly. That's what they say, a word to the wise is sufficient. A word, say a single word, you can communicate an idea. But when there's a preponderance of speech, speech is something which is a expression of the emotions, of the instincts. So that's he's showing you here, and it's very closely tied to how dreams function too. So speech is just another step after the dreams, meaning dreams where all the emotions, all the uncontrolled and unruly and completely unstructured feelings are operating. Speech is then the next step where a person starts expressing it. So that's why I said the person has to be very careful with speech, because that's just going to be when you start saying something and now you're in reality and now you take an obligation upon yourself, that has consequences. So better off don't say anything than say something great and grandeur and make yourself look good. A person's in temple and they're taking calls for donations. He wants to look like a big shot, so he yells out, I donated $500,000. And a day later, after everybody's congratulated him, now the reality hits him. So momentarily, he felt great. He was riding high. But that just comes from the emotion. Okay, let me just pause here. Let's see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Yeah, and yes. To the dreams, I don't know, something went over my head, I think. Sometimes people think that their dreams are like a message.
Yeah, that's foolish.
It's going to happen before it happens.
That's, well, there's two things about that. There's two things. One thing, first of all, is that there's no more prophecy. Prophecy has ceased.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes a person may have a dream, and sure enough, the next day it happens. All that is that a person has some good intuition, and he sensed certain things were going on. And in his dream, I guess that was a concern. He put it together, and he played it out in his head. And that's what took place the next day, just because there were certain obvious factors that were happening. It's very rare that that happens, but that can happen. A person could even think about it during the day.
Coincidence.
You don't even need a dream. A person today, on Sunday, could be thinking about certain things, and sure enough, tomorrow they happen, only because he had good intuition, and he just picked up on the fact that there were causative relationships between things. And they finally happened, it wasn't because of any prediction.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Okay. All right, so you see the tie now between both verses. In 5:2, he's talking about the but there is a slight difference. 5:2 is talking about how a dream is constructed of many matters. So that means that's because the mind is constantly working. That's why there's many matters. There's many different objects, desires, and this whole influx of stimuli. So there's much going through a person's head every day, every moment. So it takes time for a person to train himself this way. Learning, it takes time. The person has to learn to focus on a topic and think creatively, and his training of thought, you know, take years, decades. And once he finally gets to the point where he masters the method of Torah study, so then these fantasies and impulses, they start having less and less of an effect on him, because now he's steering his thoughts. And he's using his imagination for the right, not just to fantasize, but he's using his creativity, and he's working through problems and raising questions. That's really where the objective is. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So that seems to raise an interesting question. We talk about the importance of making decisions through the intellect and not through the emotions, and working with your mind. But it seems that what these two verses are pointing out is they're almost like two parts to the mind. You've got the part of the mind that is just throwing out lots of crazy ideas and imagination and static and fluff and stuff. And then there's the part where you come along and try to rationally analyze an idea, which almost causes you to have to fight against what the stream of static that your mind is putting out.
Yeah, but I believe it's akin to being on a highway going a certain way. Once you turn off the highway, now you're on another road. So what do I mean? A person typically is on a highway with a lot of static and just emotions are, you know, being thrown at him left and right. But then he sees, he gets a little taste of what, you know, Torah and wisdom is. So he makes the turn off the highway to see this beautiful view, and then he's just enamored by it. And the closer he gets, the more picturesque it is, and the further away he is from the original high that he was on. And now, after, you know, making that turn, and that turn could be, you know, a 180-degree turn, and it could take many years to be on that turn, but he now has realigned his thinking and his attention. That there's no more effort. He opens up a Chumash, he opens up the Torah or a Talmud, and has been trained to see what, you know, gems lie below the surface. That's his focus, and everything else is just tuned out. And so it's a process, but then there can be a permanent change. The only thing is, he has to continue. He has to sustain daily, because the Torah does say, if you forsake me one day, I will forsake you 2 days. Which means that if a person skips a day of learning, so what does it mean that the Torah says, if you forsake me? It's like it's personifying the Torah. The Torah, so to speak, is saying, if you leave me for one day and you don't learn for a day, I will leave you for 2 more days. It means to say that if a person abandons thought, so there's only one other area his energies can be going into, and that's the instinctual, because that's there's only two areas where our energies can flow to. There's nothing else. So if we're not involved in thought and study and rational thinking, so then we get involved in emotions. And then we'd have to withdraw them. That would take the next day. And then to reinvest them is the third day. So that's what I mean is, if you forsake me one day, so you forsook me and you didn't learn anything on Sunday. So it's not an exact thing. It's not saying it's a literal 48 hours. It means to say it's going to be twice as difficult to get back involved. Because now you've re-engaged the emotions. Now you get withdrawn from the emotions and go back into the intelligence. So you see, you do need to sustain. It has to be a daily thing. It has to be something which is, you know, a person's involved in. And the truth is, sometimes a person who has a lot of work to do, he's got to pay his bills. And that's the right thing to do. A person must work. So, but if he's looking, you know, in the back of his mind, he can't wait till he gets home, has his dinner, and spends time with his wife and kids, but he wants to get back to his learning, so then he'll sustain his learning because his energy is always going towards it. He's doing the actions that he has to do, but in the back of his mind, he's always anticipating getting back to his studies because that gives him the most enjoyment. And then when he's involved in the studies, it's completely, it's easy. And you can see it yourself. How changed of, you know, you experienced over the years, and how you have an interesting question, and that's all that's on your mind. There is no static anymore when you hear a great question.
Thank you.
Sure. All right, so he ends off the verse by saying, rather what should you do? Fear God. Meaning he's telling you, don't be living in terms of your instinctual and your own self makeup and going with this influx and the static, as you're referring to it. But rather, your attention should be to God. So it shouldn't be internal, catering to yourself. You should not be the object. Really, the object of your thought should be, you should be fearing God. And having that focus, then you will be careful about making these promises or just running through your prayer. Okay, and Irina is asking in verse 5, what does it mean that a messenger, an angel? So Irina, what that means, again, is Ibn Ezra talks about that. And the way you read the verse in an interpretative way, it would be like this. Don't allow your speech, your mouth, to cause your flesh to sin. Meaning, don't make a promise where your body doesn't keep it. So that's the flesh sinning, is not fulfilling your word. And don't say before the angel, which means don't try to give an excuse before God when you have to give an accounting after you die, that when you made a promise, you didn't do it. So that's the angel. Angel just means the vehicle by which God records all of our actions. And let me just read it to you in here. Yeah, he says don't do a sin where you don't fulfill the words of your mouth, and you should know that God's eyes are facing towards the steps of every man. And he counts them all. And the angel that is ministers before God is appointed to write down in the book all of the speech that comes out of a person's mouth. So angel here just means to say that there's a system in place. So that's what we said. Malach in Hebrew means like work. Malacha, it's the same word. So it performs a task. So God has a system. However the system works, he has a system by which man's activities are recorded, as well as his speech. And here, specifically, we're talking about speech. So when he says, don't say before the angel that, oh, the promise you made was a speech, it really had no meaning, don't try to use that. Meaning, don't try to defend yourself against what God has recorded in terms of reactions. Okay? Hope that's clear, Irina. And Irina, also, just you should know, because this is the first time you're joining, that we record the classes and we put them on the audio link. So if Lev is not there or anybody else, you know, in the community, they want to hear it, you go to the audio link and you'll be able to replay any of the classes. You'll see it by date. Okay? All righty.
Rabbi.
Go ahead, Doug.
So at the end of the verse, when it says only fear God, in this context, how would you define fearing God?
I would say it means that the focus should not be in terms of catering to the emotional impulses, the imagination. So you shouldn't be responding to that, and whenever you have a certain itch, you should scratch it, meaning whenever you have a certain desire to give in. But your focus should be, because why does a person make a statement that he's going to do, he's going to make an oath, and he doesn't fulfill it? Evidently, it's not because of a conviction. If it was conviction, he would fulfill it. So it must be because he's catering to some emotion in himself, and that's why. So that's why he says, King Solomon ends off the verse by saying, the way you correct this problem is that you're always on guard and you don't act just to satisfy your emotional desires, but his ego, making big promises in the temple in front of, you know, 500 other members that are going to ooh and ah, how much you just donated, you know, verbally. What a person should do is fear God. That should be his reality and understand his accountability. All right. Let's see if, let's just take a look at the commentaries and see if they elaborate. Right, so Swarno says very well. He says like this, and he says, what does it mean at the end that, and, but rather you should fear God? He says like this, quote, I say that the guard against all these things, it is fitting that a person should fear God, blessed be he, because of his greatness. And he should consider the evil, the great evil, if God gets angry at him. So a person should therefore not enter himself into this danger. So as I said, the great guard against doing all these things, of, he basically talked about two areas. It's all had to do with speech. But the first was about going to the temple and just being very rote in your prayers or giving sacrifices without proper intent. And you should know that if a person has the wrong intent when he gives a sacrifice, it nullifies the whole sacrifice. It's an amazing thing. The animal can be the most beautiful goat. Flawless, not a, you know, a discoloration, not any type of a blemish. It can be the most prized animal, but if he has the wrong intention at a certain point in the sacrifice, it can nullify the entire sacrifice, and he has to bring another one. So that's one thing, and also we spoke about prayer. The person shouldn't just go to the temple, and then we talked about how the commentators cite God's ridicule of the Jews when they came to his temple, and they didn't do it for the right reasons. So God says, who asked you to be trampling in my courtyard? Because that's all it really ends up to be. With all their money and all their animals that they're bringing a sacrifice, but if they're doing it for the wrong reason or the wrong intent, or they're just trying to relieve themselves of an obligation, but they don't have the proper understanding of what sacrifice is and what prayer is. So then all it is to God is that you just say, you're crushing the grass in my courtyard. Leave. I mean, it shows the contrast. So that's one area was prayer, because that's speech. And the other one is also in terms of oaths. And the person can be corrupt in both ways. He was doing this out of his own emotional drives as opposed to understanding clearly what it's about. And having the right intent, because like we said earlier, the intellect is more engaged in speech than it is in any other action. Okay, so again, Sforno says that the guard against all these is that you should fear God and understand his greatness. And then also contemplate, you know, like Pirkei Avos says, the person should, before he does any action, he should measure out the matter. He should gauge, is the punishment really worth the, you know, few moments of pleasure, and so on and so forth. Or a person has to toil a lot to do a mitzvah, so he should measure out and say, is the energy I put in really that precious to me? But 1 minute, I'll have a great reward if I do fulfill the mitzvah. So a person should gauge out things properly. That's what he's saying here. A person should consider the evil, the great evil. If he angers God, then he enters himself into some sort of a danger, because now God may punish him. So to answer your question, it's King Solomon saying that your orientation has to be corrected if you're going to be on guard against this. And what's the orientation? Like Sforno was saying, focus on God. Recognize, and that even if it means that you have to function out of a fear of punishment, that's much better. Of course, functioning out of a love of the truth is the highest. But either one of those is of course, much more preferable than a person just functioning out of his own emotions. The same area that creates all his dreams is now going to cause him to make all this speech. He's just a bundle of emotions. Make sense, Doug?
Yes, I think so. Thank you. Can we interpret the idea of Sforno that when it says the great, evil, if God is angry with you, I mean, it seems like it would be easy to extrapolate that God's just a big mad dad, and so I better toe the line or he'll beat me up. Can we instead interpret that to be that I simply need to consider the consequences or the natural consequences that will occur? As opposed to, I mean, when Sforno says that as, the great calamity if God becomes angry with you, it's hard for me to get out that idea of, an angry person with a big stick, if you will. And I'm guessing that's not what Sforno means, but what do you think about that?
Well, I think both is true, that there is physical punishment. That's why he says in the verse that why should you make God angry and then he'll destroy the work of your hands? Right? That the reality of the book of Job, whether it was a reality or not, that the reality of the concept, he lost his family, all his property, he's smit with leprosy, head to toe. I mean, that's a negative thing. A person should want to avoid that. But there's also, like you're saying, which I agree, that it's just the natural thing, that you're hurting your soul, whatever you sin. Even without God stepping in, it's your own self-destruction. A person's putting their energies into something which is sinful, so it's now pulling them away from perfection. It could be a permanent change. And that's something a person's got to really contemplate. And really, the question is, where does a person's values lie? Unfortunately, people do get too caught up into this world, and this is everything, the sensual, what I see, what I experience. I've been here for decades. So I'm so convinced that that is a reality. But the chacham, the wise person, knows he's temporarily here and he can control himself. And he everybody has emotions and they flare up from time to time. But the person trains it more and more, becomes more under his control.
Well, didn't Job have all that calamity not because of a particular sin?
Yeah, it's because of ignorance. But that still itself was a problem. He had a false notion of God's justice.
I see.
So that itself removed him. And as Rabbi Shade explained, by the way, do you know that we put together all his classes? He had like 9 classes. We wrote it up, a bunch of the people at Yeshiva. And we made a book in English. So.
I did get that.
Okay, good. And we actually just put out this week another one. We took all of Rabbi Chait's writings and put it together in a new book. So if anybody wants, it's actually online already. It's at ybt.org/philosophyoftorah.pdf. But there's also a hard copy, too, that we made.
Thank you very much for that. That was really great.
Okay, good.
philosophyoflife.pdf.
It's ybt.org/philosophyoftorah.pdf.
P as in Paul, P as in Baker, S as in Sam?
Like a PDF file. Peter, David, Frank.
Oh, Peter, PDF. Okay, thank you.
like I said, if anybody wants, you know, we'd, I think it costs like $9, $10, you know, for copy, you know, you could have a hard copy of it. I guess I was saying that the Rabbi Shea explained that at the end of the book, when Job finally admitted to Elihu, because his three friends, Bildad, Zophar, and Eliphaz, they were trying to justify why he had all these punishments. Either because you really did do something, but you forgot, or because you can't know God's ways, or the third opinion was that you didn't do anything wrong, but this will be a source of reward for you in the next world. So he refuted all three of those theories, which are the most prominent theories. People have it today. They think we have something negative happening. You know, it's not necessarily because you did something wrong, but it'll be a source of reward. But he refused that. God doesn't punish unless a person does something wrong. And the other one said that you can't know how God works. So to a certain extent, that's right, but not when it comes to human justice. Man has to feel God is just. And then the other opinion was that he was getting all this because he did something wrong, but he forgot about it. So he said, no. God says in the Torah openly that the hidden things are to God. Only the revealed things are for us. That's a verse in Deuteronomy, meaning that God only holds you accountable for that sin which you recall doing. If you can't remember doing a sin, it was so long ago, so then it's not fair that God should hold you accountable, because if your person honestly forgot something, so then how is he going to be able to correct himself? So it's an interesting level of kindness. But it is a verse in the Torah. So, but once it was after Elihu stepped in and said that, do you understand how God makes lightning and snow and the ostrich lays its egg? I mean, all the different areas of the physical world. So he admitted that he doesn't understand how the physical world works. So then Elihu's whole point was, well, certainly you can't understand more abstract things like God's justice. And then he acquiesced. Job acquiesced. And once he did acquiesce, Rabbi Shea explained, that's when God stepped in. Now he brought himself to a higher level because he admitted having harboring a certain incorrect thought. Okay. How does that answer your original question, though?
I'm sorry, Robert, are you talking to me?
Yes, Doug.
I think I'm okay. I struggle with the whole issue of sort of not being angry with you per se, and I'm trying to balance that with, you know, our discussions in Proverbs,
right,
that fear of God is really just the recognition that there's a natural set of consequences and God has gotcha as well. So.
Well, of course, God can't be angry. I mean, that's a human emotion, so we have to be clear that anger is just means to say that it's an expression that what we're doing in that case is we're going against his will, like God was angry with Moses in yesterday's Parsha. At a certain point in the dialogue about Moses going and becoming the God's emissary to Paro, there was no anger. Then all of a sudden, it says God's angry. So, of course, it doesn't mean angry. It means at that point, it was not a justified response from Moses. And we can understand it also means that God's angry means that we're hurting ourselves. We're doing something which is against his will for us. And his will is completely for our own benefit. So we definitely have to remove that idea about God being any type of human condition, any type of, you know, can't personify him at all. And that's why you have to take all those statements in the Torah where God's jealous or he sets his face against the man who does idolatry. Each one of those statements have to be understood in a specific context. Any other questions? All right, so think it over. Look again if you want. Look over the verses more. And anybody who joined for the first time, like, you know, Irina or anybody else, you have all the recorded classes if you want to just fill in. But again, each time we do the class, it is an independent study. So you're not losing anything by, you know, coming once or twice, or if you didn't have the the previous couple of classes behind you. So don't worry about that. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up. We'll pick up next week. We'll move on to verse 7. All right, so we'll do 5-7 next Sunday, same time.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a good week, everybody.
All right, thanks, Rabbi.
My pleasure. If you have any questions, also follow up.
Everybody have a good week. Good. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Okay, if there's any follow-up questions during the week, you know, feel free to email me or call, whatever you want. Okay, so have a good week, everybody.